Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for September 14th, 2007. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, is dark matter warm? Using light to treat mental illnesses, including Alzheimer's. New insight into ethnic violence. And what is gonzo science? All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science and technology for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Understanding what the universe is made of is not so easy when you can't really measure most of it. Dark matter. And so far, astronomers and cosmologists can only infer that dark matter exists because of gravitational effects on objects we can see, such as stars. In a paper in this week's Science, Liang Gao and Tom Thunes propose a new, warm, dark matter hypothesis that sheds some light even on how stars form. I spoke with Thunes at Durham University in the United Kingdom.
So after the Big Bang, the universe was expanding rapidly. It stayed mostly smooth and dark, okay, for about 100 million years. And structures start to grow because of dark matter. The dark matter gravity pulled in hydrogen, helium, and lithium, and that would form stars. Now, we know very little about what the dark matter is. We know very well that it's there. The evidence for its existence is really overwhelming. But we know very little what the dark matter is. Now, usually, people assume that the dark matter consists of particles that are moving very slowly. That is called cold dark matter. And if the dark matter is cold, then even very small ripples in the universe will grow. And these will form into small halos, spherical concentrations of dark matter, and those would pull in gas and form stars. But because we don't know really what the dark matter is, we investigated what would happen if the particles were moving faster, and that's called warm dark matter.
Is there a hot dark matter? What is?
So hot dark matter would be particles that move even faster. And in fact, the first suggestion of what the dark matter would be in the 1970s by a famous Russian called Seldovich, he suggested, well, we know that neutrinos exist. We can measure them in the laboratory. We know that there's very many of them. If these particles have mass, which at that time wasn't known whether they had mass or not, then those could be hot dark matter. Those could be the dark matter. And we know now that although it's true that neutrinos have mass, the way that stars and galaxies form in a hot dark matter universe would be very, very different from what we see. So in a sense, that rules out that most of the mass in the universe is in the form of hot dark matter. So that's then, well, when people say, well, if it's not hot, maybe we should try the dark matter being cold. And that's why people started studying cold dark matter.
So they knew that it couldn't have been hot because of how the computer simulations worked out? Is that it?
That's right. So it's not just computer simulations, but also analytical modeling. It's pretty clear that, so in a sense, hot dark matter exists because neutrinos exist and they have mass. But it's only a very small fraction of what constitutes the dark matter in the universe. So most of it is not hot. In a sense, there is hot dark matter. But the majority of the dark matter cannot be hot.
So we went from hot dark matter to cold dark matter, and now we're to warm dark matter.
Indeed. So there's a huge difference between hot dark matter on the one hand and cold or warm dark matter. But as far as most of the properties of the galaxies are concerned, and especially the distribution of galaxies, whether the dark matter is warm or cold doesn't make any difference. And that's why, you know, observations of galaxies or in the way they're clustered cannot tell us whether the dark matter is cold or warm. You really need to look at something on very, very small scales so that these small velocities of the particles have an effect on what it is you're looking at. And so that's why my collaborator, Liang Gao, and I did supercomputer simulations of the formation of the first stars, because these form in very small dark matter concentrations. And so these small dark matter concentrations are very much affected by whether the dark matter is warm or cold.
How do things work under these two theories?
So in cold dark matter, the computer simulations suggest that per spherical dark matter concentration, you form at most one star, okay? But it's very, very different in warm dark matter. Because of this thermal velocity of the dark matter particles, the first structures that you form are very long strings, which we call filaments. And these filaments are already massive enough to pull in gas and form stars. And so it's not just where the stars form, which is likely to be very different between warm dark matter and cold dark matter, but potentially the properties of the stars, the masses of the stars themselves, could be potentially very different. All the way from small stars with masses of a solar mass or even below the mass of the sun, maybe all the way up to much more massive stars. But the interesting thing is that these low mass stars, because they have low mass, they live much longer. And so they could potentially live even today. So maybe the Milky Way galaxy could have some of these first stars if the dark matter is warm. Whereas if the dark matter is cold, these first stars would long be gone.
It's really a question then, it sounds like, of whether or not what we see now bears out one theory over the other. Is there something that we're seeing now? You had mentioned the Milky Way galaxy.
So if you were to look at very, very low metallicity stars in the Milky Way today, the metals, so in astronomy these are called metals, but it's all elements which are not hydrogen and helium. And we know stars in the Milky Way already that have abundances maybe 100 times lower than the sun. Okay, so the fraction of iron in that star is 100 times lower, 100,000 times lower than it is in the sun. And so in those stars you can see, so what is the abundance pattern? Because maybe that is imprinted by these very first stars. Metals are put in that star when it formed long time ago and they just remain in there. And so we can still today measure the abundance pattern of these very low metallicity stars. And by doing so, we can try to find out what the mass of the first star was just from the abundance pattern. And so try to constrain whether it's true that there are these very massive stars that are produced in cold dark matter with masses, say, 100 solar masses, 200 solar masses, or whether the warm dark matter stars have masses which are in better agreement with these supernova calculations for producing the abundance pattern that you see now.
So in the case of a cold dark matter theory, It sounds like you would expect maybe a different distribution pattern than you would in the warm dark matter theory. And what you're seeing in the Milky Way, for example, in a couple of stars in the Milky Way, are some of these very old, low metallicity stars that could be stars that have survived since the formation of early stars.
That's right.
And as a result, those metallicity ratios suggest a warm dark matter theory over a cold dark matter theory.
So it's you know, as in any good science, there is uncertainties in predictions. But at the moment, I would say that they fit in better with warm dark matter predictions than with cold dark matter predictions.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Very good. Thank you.
Tom Thunes, along with collaborator Liang Gao, write Lighting the Universe with Filaments in the September 14th issue of Science. Also in this week's Science, sterile salmon give birth to trout. Tomoyuki Okutsu and colleagues report successfully transplanting both male and female reproductive tissues from trout into sterile salmon. Using these surrogate techniques, they generated trout gametes from the salmon and produced a generation of donor-derived fish. The research suggests that it may be a way to bring back extinct species and preserve endangered populations of salmonid fish, which include both trout and salmon. Read the brevium Production of Trout Offspring from Triploid Salmon Parents in the September 14th issue of Science. Resetting your circadian clock isn't as simple as turning a dial or pushing a button. This is your body's clock, and while it's usually on a 24-hour cycle, it isn't always in sync with the sun. Researchers had found that resetting a person's circadian clock can help with seasonal affective disorder, or the wintertime blues. But new research is finding that it can help with many other mental disorders too, including Alzheimer's. Science news writer Udijit Bhattacharjee reports on it in this week's issue.
This is a story about how the circadian clock influences mental health, and how resetting the circadian clock to bring it in alignment with all of the circadian rhythms in the body might work to improve mental health and, in fact, treat disorders such as bipolar disorder and other mood disorders.
So it's not just seasonal affective disorder or SAD anymore?
No, it goes well beyond SAD, and it covers a whole spectrum of anxiety and mood disorders that researchers think are connected to circadian rhythms.
Before we get to those, how do you treat seasonal affective disorder without the use of pharmaceutical drugs?
Well, one very effective method is light therapy. And what researchers found back in the 1980s when they discovered seasonal affective disorder was that it could be treated by exposing the patient to a few hours of bright light in the morning and in the evening. So in other words, researchers used bright light as an agent to reset or shift the circadian clock and bring it into alignment with the rest of the rhythms in the patient's body. And that seemed to have a remarkable antidepressant effect in patients with SAD.
So it felt more like spring or fall?
They did end up with that feeling. However, researchers weren't really clear if the antidepressant effect of light was because of the lengthening of their day or the photoperiod, as it is known to circadian researchers, or if there was something else at play. And what researchers have found recently is that there's some strong evidence to suggest that it's not the length of the day that is the driver of this antidepressant effect, but rather the ability of light to shift all of the circadian rhythms in the patient and bring them into alignment with the person's sleep and wake cycle.
So it sounds like scientists don't know exactly why seasonal affective disorder or SAD happens or why the various treatments work exactly, but they've got some hypotheses that they're testing.
And there's two hypotheses. The first one, the older one, is known as the photoperiod hypothesis. And the second one is known as the phase shift hypothesis. And what the story describes is some evidence to support the second hypothesis, even though the hypothesis is still not accepted by any kind of consensus. But there seems to be some strong evidence to support the phase shift hypothesis, which is that light shifts all of the circadian rhythms and brings them into alignment and thereby uplifts the patient's mood.
Okay, so that's for seasonal affective disorder. What about some of these other mental disorders? Is it possible that these kinds of treatments would be effective in treating those too?
These kinds of treatments do seem promising for some other disorders like bipolar disorder, for instance. They also seem to have a positive effect in patients with Alzheimer's disease. And that's what the latter half of the story talks about. It describes some of the more recent studies. Even though these studies involve small groups of patients, researchers have found that using light and using some other techniques to tinker with the body clock is able to deliver a therapeutic effect in patients with bipolar disorder, with certain other anxiety disorders, even in pregnant women who often suffer from depression and are unable to use antidepressant medication because of concerns that it might affect the fetus. So yes, there is evidence that these treatments might be valuable, if not alone, maybe in conjunction with traditional antidepressant medication in treating patients with other mood disorders.
Now, you mentioned small numbers for the number of people participating in at least the Alzheimer's test. Is there something else that might be holding it up? It seems like there are a lot of Alzheimer's patients, or are people just not generally volunteering?
Well, one problem that researchers have reported is a lack of funding. You have to keep in mind that the world of medicine today is dominated by what is known as the pharma model, which is the belief that people have that by either injecting something into patients or by taking pills, you can bring about a healing effect. And so anything that falls outside of that mainstream of medicine seems to have a difficult time in getting funding. even though researchers who have been testing these treatments, and by these treatments I mean manipulating the circadian clock by either using light or by shifting the sleep-wake cycle somehow, they claim that these treatments are doing things inside the body that are very similar to what are achieved by pumping pills or injections into a person. And so they are trying to get more evidence out there on the front lines that it does make sense to investigate these therapies as a possible treatment for several mood disorders.
So it's the lack of patentability then that prevents this from getting out there as much, or?
That really nobody stands to gain very much from light therapy, certainly not the pharma industry. Of course, patients would stand to benefit from it. Likewise, melatonin, which is a hormone, is also a natural product and therefore can't be patented. And so the pharma industry certainly has not been supremely enthusiastic about investigating these treatments, simply because it doesn't seem to fit into their whole profit model. But researchers are hoping that with more federal funding, and perhaps with funding from foundations, they'll be able to develop larger studies and get more and better evidence, if the evidence exists, in large-scale trials to show that these treatments have a positive effect.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time and for sharing this story with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Science news writer Yudhijit Bhattacharjee writes about the circadian clock's effects on mental health. Read more about it in the September 14th issue of Science. Also this week in Science, tracing the environmental toxin mercury. Bridget Bergquist and Joel Bloom found a natural process in which the isotopes of mercury, with odd values of atomic mass, did not separate according to that mass, as which happens in most chemical reactions. Knowing about this natural process of mass-independent fractionation will help researchers trace more of the mercury that gets into the environment and through the food web. Read the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. Ethnic violence. It's led to the deaths of millions of people in the past decade alone. And one of the challenges facing policymakers is knowing when and where it's going to happen. Now, Mei Lim, Richard Metzler, and Yanir Bar-Yam report in a paper that they have developed a computer model for identifying where ethnic violence may occur. This very accurate model, with correlation at or above 0.9 on data from India and the former Yugoslavia, uses population statistics, a Monte Carlo simulation, and a Mexican Hat wavelet filter. I spoke to Yanir Bar-Yam from his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
The main issue here is recognizing very general patterns that exist in nature. Ethnic violence appears under conditions that we can recognize. The research shows that it occurs in circumstances of pattern formation where areas are differentiating by culture. So let's say you start with a mixed set of ethnic groups, and over time they separate. That process is very universal. It happens in chemical systems, in physical systems, in biological systems. And by being attuned to these very universal processes, we can recognize that they're taking place in the world in this context, and consider how those universal processes might be related to ethnic violence.
So it sounds like ethnic violence is, in a sense, similar to a chemical reaction, say, or these other universal patterns that are out there. So certain ethnic population patterns are more likely to be reactive, if you will?
Well, basically, there are two parts to the model. The first part is a dynamical aspect, which is the process by which populations change their geographical distribution. So it's a very natural concept, and if you like common parlance, the idea of birds of a feather flock together, what happens in human populations is that over time, people tend to want to be near others of similar type. And when that process is sufficiently strong, then the spatial arrangement of people tends to result in groupings of people. and those groupings grow in size over time. So that's part one of the model. The second part of the model is relating that to ethnic violence. And there, the recognition is that when people are well mixed, they're unlikely to engage in violence with each other. And when people are well separated, they're unlikely to engage in violence. But at a particular size of separation, you have the beginning of individuals identifying the space around them as being associated with their group. And at the same time, you have the other group violating whatever social or behavioral conventions are associated with their ethnic group. And that creates the kind of underlying friction or tension that can give rise to violence under the appropriate triggering events. So our work uses both of those ideas and then evaluates the existing population structure in order to identify regions of likely violence in a particular area.
So what kind of patterning is predictive of ethnic violence?
When you have islands or peninsulas of one type into another type, so they're mostly surrounded by the other type, then there's a difficulty to differentiate the regions, and the boundaries are in a sense unclear, and there's a certain size of islands or peninsulas where there would be lack of clarity. And the process of studying the model, we identify the typical size of such islands or peninsulas that would be problematic, and that's how we identify areas of likely violence.
To the model itself, what types of equations did you use?
So there are two levels of understanding of the equations. There is a simple model that we used to represent the process of pattern formation, and there is a process that we use to detect islands and peninsulas of likely conflict. The first is an agent-based model representing different ethnic groups with agents that are tagged by their ethnic group. And they are moving around in a space with preference to be near the same type. Detection of islands and peninsulas is done using filters applied to the spatial model. We specifically used wavelet filters, but the details are not important to the outcome. And one of the main things in all of this is that the concept of universality, which says that many of the details are not important, is essential to enabling us to do the modeling.
How did you test this prediction model?
The model was tested against data from two places. One is the former Yugoslavia, which had extensive violence during the 1990s. And so using census of the ethnic composition of the country by area, by region, we constructed a representation of the population groups and used that to identify areas of violence and then compared that with the violence that was actually reported. And the census was done before the violence broke out so that it could be used as an identifier of the ability to predict the ethnic violence. The other place that we studied was India, where again, there are areas in which violence has been very strong, and we used a census in India to check that the model could predict the areas of violence.
And how accurate was the model?
Actually, remarkably so. I mean, the model does not include many things that could be relevant to violence, and that one can use just the spatial distribution of population and not include many other factors that surely have some relevance to ethnic violence and still find a very, very good identification of the areas of violence was quite remarkable.
So it's not something then that would account for, say, a dictator who has a particular feelings about one particular ethnic group or another?
No, it's surely quite clear that given a system which has very, very strict control over the population, that would suppress the appearance of ethnic violence. So we did not include that, but, you know, as an extrinsic force that would suppress the violence, at least in a temporary way, such factors are clearly important.
It sounds a bit like the model promotes separation of ethnic groups or this sort of dictatorial control over them. But at the same time, folks living in regions of highly mixed ethnicities do not interact violently, you had said. What can policymakers take away from this?
Well, I think there are policies historically and even in the present that are aware of this. In Singapore, where they impose mixing of populations in the housing that's available in Singapore. And there have been various attempts historically to create boundaries between groups in order to reduce the likelihood of violence. One can say that the scientific study, number one, is a starting point for scientific evaluation of ethnic violence from a certain perspective. Number two, that from the point of view of policy, it provides some concepts and framework for considering policies. And number three, bringing the two together by doing more research that is more specifically relevant to policies in a particular area can provide increased insight into the impact that those policies will take. It's not that the scientific research is prescriptive, but rather provides some guidance that can be taken into consideration by policymakers.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Good.
Yanir Baryam is the author, with May Lim and Richard Metzler, of Global Pattern Formation and Ethnic Cultural Violence. Read more about it in the September 14th issue of Science. What is Gonzo Science? As science correspondent John Bohannon describes it, it's when an author writing about science cannot extract himself from the science or the story of it. This week, he's launching a new occasional column in that spirit on science's website called, aptly enough, The Gonzo Scientist. I spoke with Bohannon from Vienna, Austria, and I began by asking him what Gonzo Science is going to be all about.
Well, I'll tell you when I find out. The term Gonzo Scientist actually was nothing that occurred to me immediately. I knew I wanted to do a regular column for Science, but I was actually struggling for a long time about what to call it. So the original title was going to be Science a la Mode, because I wanted to find something that sort of mixes science with culture in some way, which is the essence of the column. But Science a la Mode just sounded like a dessert. And then I kind of gave up on that line of reasoning. It seemed too obvious. So then I started to get some strange titles like Scientists in the Midst. That's nice, a reference to Gorillas in the Mist. But, it just seemed a bit too primate-centric. Then I came upon The Third Vulture, which is a play on The Third Culture.
Wow.
But it made me sound kind of like a carrion eater, so I skipped that. My favorite was Sex, 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 and Science. I thought that would get attention.
That would.
I couldn't get that past editorial.
Okay.
And finally, I settled on The Gonzo Scientist because the term gonzo was coined to describe a style of journalism that was created by Hunter S. Thompson in the 60s and 70s. And it's not that I'm emulating Hunter S. Thompson at all, but I really like the term because it means that you do the opposite of what you should do as a journalist, in a sense. Traditionally, a journalist is supposed to be an observer who is not involved.
This is the objectivity versus subjectivity, right?
Right. Remove from the action. And that's not what I want to do. I want to get involved as possible to provide an insider's view on what's going on. And it also describes the kind of people that I'm meeting during these adventures. So often there are scientists who are collaborating with artists, and they're doing things that are quite different from the scientific approach. So, for example, I've met physicists who work with dancers to create a dance interpretation of cosmology. I just got back from a summer camp where scientists are mixing it up with non-scientists and talking about scientific ideas, but trying to find interesting ways to cross disciplines. And the only way to really report on that sort of thing is to get involved yourself.
Sort of a first-person narrative, and you're really going to sort of jump in there with the scientists and artists and or others that are making this story happen.
Yeah, it's all in first person. So I think that's the only honest way to report this kind of event.
Now, the style of storytelling, you mentioned Hunter S. Thompson and the Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, I think was his most popular work. But it's also a style of storytelling that mixes factual events with a fictional tale.
That's right.
How did editorial take that reference?
Yeah, that's kind of a risky aspect to it. We don't want to imply that this is, you know, completely exaggerated or fictionalized. It's not the case at all. It's real-world reporting. I'm not making anything up. The part of the term gonzo that I hope to capture is just the sense of adventure and getting involved with the action as part of the reporting.
And who's primarily the audience for this?
Well, I think scientists will be very interested because that's the red line running through all this, is that science is involved in some way, science or scientists. That said, I hope it appeals to everyone. I haven't written it in any technical, jargony way, and I'm relating experiences that everyone has had in one way or another. So it should be accessible to all.
Okay.
And it'll be regularly available on the Science website.
You're doing audio, right?
So it's a story that you read,
mm-hmm.
and then there's also an audio slideshow.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it should be fun. It's an experiment.
Like every good scientist, right?
Well, we'll see.
And your working hypothesis is?
My working hypothesis is that science and culture are great to mix together. More and more people are doing it, and I'm going to try and dive in and find the most interesting things going on and tell people about it. So the adventure's just begun.
Well, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for the call, Rob.
Science correspondent John Bohannon this week launches The Gonzo Scientist, a new online feature at Science. You can find the series at www.sciencemag.org/SCIEXT/GonzoScientist. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news service, Science Now, is in the studio with the journal's online editor, Stuart Wills, for our usual roundup of other recent stories.
David, welcome back. What's on the list today?
Well, Stuart, I will give you our list based on three questions. What do Pavlov's dogs have to do with being a better breeder? How can a single gene make people better marathon runners? And finally, what can DNA tell us about the status of Pacific gray whales?
Okay, sounds good. Well, let's start with Pavlov's dogs, or I guess you could say Pavlov's quails.
Right. So Pavlov's dogs, as most people know, about 100 years ago, a researcher named Ivan Pavlov trained dogs to salivate when he rang a bell. And basically, he did this by he would ring a bell, give the dogs food, and very quickly the dogs learned to associate the bell with food, and he could ring the bell without giving them food, and they would begin to salivate. And this is called conditioned learning or conditioning. And researchers know it's very prevalent in the animal kingdom, but they really don't know how it evolved, how it's stuck with us. What are the mechanisms that pass it from generation to generation? So they wonder if it might have something to do with sex, which is a good
What doesn't?
What right? doesn't, right? So what they did was they studied quails, as you said. And the reason they studied quails is because quails breed very well in captivity. And like the dogs, they trained the quails to associate certain environments with sex. And what they did was they put a quail in a box that either had green walls or tilted floors for a few minutes. And then after the quail was in the box, it got to breed with a female. And very quickly, these quails learned that, hey, if I'm in this box, I'm a romantic liaison is coming up very quickly. So they were conditioned for breeding by being in these boxes. And then what they did was they took a couple of quails, one that they put in the box that it had been conditioned into, and one they put in an unfamiliar box. They put them both in a cage with a female and let them have at it. And usually when this happens, one male or the other will have about a 50% chance of being the father of the female quail's offspring, as you might expect. But what they discovered is that the conditioned quails had a 72% chance of being the father. So they were significantly more likely to be the fathers when they were
in the same number of liaisons.
In the same number of liaisons, exactly.
So there was something going on in their sperm?
Right. Somehow being conditioned to expect sex, there was something going on physiologically. And the researchers haven't figured this out yet, but they think that maybe when the quails are anticipating sex, they are boosting their sperm number or something. They don't know what it is, but at least it gives a mechanism for how something like conditioning can be passed on from generation to generation.
So it's not just pleasure in the anticipation of sex. There's actually a fitness dimension there.
Exactly.
Well, there's nothing like a good sex story to get us started. Let's move on to the next story, which is somewhat more quotidian on long-distance runners.
Right. And so if you want to know anything about running, you've got to know that there's two types of skeletal muscle fibers. One type is fast fibers. And as you might expect, these fibers are for quick forces when running, such as you might expect that you would use when you're sprinting. And these fibers use sugar and don't require oxygen. And the other kind of fiber is known as a slow fiber, which you also might expect has something to do with slower running. Well, not really slower running, but maybe something more along the lines of long distance running, endurance running. And these slow fibers do use oxygen. And what researchers know already is that there's a protein called alpha-actinin 3, which is made mostly by FAS fibers. And so researchers suspected that this protein was somehow involved in making people maybe better sprinters. And they knew that people that had mutations in this gene, which inactivated it, were more likely to be better at long distance running. And the people that had fewer mutations were better at sprinting. So they thought that the protein had something to do with telling us whether we were going to be a sprinter or a marathon runner if we were inclined to running, but they didn't really know how it worked. So what they did was they knocked out this gene in mice, and lo and behold, they found that mice without the gene or that couldn't produce this alpha-actinin 3 protein did much better in endurance running.
They put them on. They were just born marathoners.
They were born marathon runners. They put them on a little mice treadmill, and they could run for about 33% longer distances than their counterparts that had the normal protein. So then the researchers looked at the evolutionary history of the gene to figure out how it's changed over the course of human evolution. And so they sequenced the gene and they looked at it in Europeans, Asians, and Africans. And what they found is that it appears that over the course of evolutionary history, this gene has been selected for in such a way that it's given an adaptive advantage to humans that would have mutated versions of this gene.
Well, why would this mutant strain have evolved at all?
The jury's still out on that, but perhaps there was something about being more of an endurance runner that was more advantageous millions of years ago than being a better sprinter. Maybe it had to do with the distance we had to outrun our predators like lions and tigers and things like that. But the researchers aren't speculating on that at the moment.
And finally, a somewhat sobering report on the gray whale. I guess the comeback of this species has been a bit overstated.
Right. What was supposed to be good news, which turns out maybe it's not so good news, and it concerns a population of gray whales in the eastern North Pacific Ocean. And about 13 years ago, scientists studying numbers of these whales, which they do by relying on historical catch records and whalers' logs, had estimated that this population, which was once very heavily decimated due to whaling and a bunch of other things, seemed to have made a comeback and seemed to have reached its historic highs, which the researchers estimated were somewhere between 20 and 40,000 individuals. But a team of researchers thought that these logs that the people had been relying on were incomplete. And in fact, historic numbers may have been a lot higher than we thought. And so they did genetic analysis on a group of the whales. And what they found was they found a surprisingly high genetic diversity in the whales. And what that means is that suggests that there was actually a very large population of these whales in the past. And the researchers estimate that population was somewhere as much as 100,000 or even close to 120,000, which is 3 to 5 times more than people have been estimating.
So still a long way to go a comeback for
right,
these whales.
Right. And what's making things worse is the researchers look at the effects of climate change in these whales. And what they see is that warming ocean temperatures are actually changing where their prey species are going. And they seem to be moving into different areas. And that's really hurting these whales' ability to feed. So sort of a double knock really for these whales. First of all, that their numbers aren't as positive as we thought, and also their numbers could be declining in the foreseeable future as the ocean temperatures continue to rise.
Well, kind of a sobering picture. David, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Stuart.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of Science. You can catch up with these and other stories on the site at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
And that wraps up the September 14th, 2007 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.